I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The newest book from Lyndon McIntyre is called Why Men Lie. It's a conclusion to his Cape Breton trilogy, which began with The Long Stretch in 1999 and was followed by The Bishop's Man, which won the 2009 Scotiabank Giller Prize. In this novel, we see men through the eyes of Effie McCaskill-Gillis. She's the sister of the Bishop Duncan McCaskill of the last book. We'll get Mr. McIntyre, who joins me now, to tell us about the book. We'll ask him why men lie and more. Lyndon McIntyre is the co-host of The Fifth Estate and the winner of at least 9 Gemini Awards for broadcast journalism. This book is published by Random House. The book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Lyndon McIntyre. Mr. McIntyre, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How do you find time to write fiction, being a journalist, having the Fifth Estate job and all that?
Well, I guess the biggest factor is that I'm an early morning person. I'm usually awake pretty early before anybody wants anything from me, before I have much to do. So if I have, I've always got some kind of a story in the back of my head that's either too complex or too large or too abstract for TV or journalism, and I get up in the early morning hours, and I, it's my time. I spend it trying to develop whatever that story might be, and it's amazing. You do a little bit every day, and suddenly a little bit turns into a lot.
Now, when you set out to write the first novel over 10 years ago, did you see 3 books?
Yeah, it was actually back in the 80s. I came up with the idea of writing 3 books based on just the challenges of getting by 3 different characters who had been, their lives had been complicated and compromised by the behavior of parents, who in turn had been profoundly affected by a war. And so these parents never really disclosed much to the kids, but except through the way they acted out their own demons. And they, they complicated the lives of their kids. The kids therefore complicate other people's lives without really knowing that the origin of some of their trauma is in something that happened long ago, far away, to people that they may never have really known much about.
What was your childhood like in Cape Breton?
Childhood was peaceful and quiet. There was a lot of anxiety related to economic uncertainty. My father was always on the go. He was always away, most of the time anyway. He was away looking for work. He was an itinerant hard rock miner. He had no formal education at all. He just never went to school at all. But he had all the literate skills that you need. He could read, write, and express himself and do complex mathematics, which all of which he picked up himself. But if you don't have the certificates and the paper, nobody takes you very seriously. So that the only work he could get was really hard physical labor, working as an underground miner, sometimes as an underground mining boss. But he was gone all the time. So my life was basically rooted in a household run by women. Mother, grandmother, I had no brothers. So I had a lot of exposure to the female personality. It was a small village place, population of about 110 people. A little school with 2 rooms and not a whole lot of amenities in the community. But a very, very established culture, a sort of folk culture, oral culture of storytelling and music. You made your own music. You made up your own stories. So in that sense, it was a very vivid and great place for an imagination to develop.
You mentioned that you grew up in a house that was run by women. This book is written from a female perspective. I understand that some of your female friends wondered how you would dare to do that, but I guess from the way where you grew up, that came naturally, did it?
Well, sort of. I mean, you have to be able, I guess, in any kind of creative pursuit, you have to be able to take on, whether it's acting or writing or performing, you take on personas that are presumably other personas than your own. You have to be able to find a place in kind of a universal perspective and somehow express yourself through that. So you can either do it or you can't do it, I guess, and it's probably a gift to be able to do it. But in my case, to take on a female point of view, it took a lot of gall. At the same time, I knew very well there were a bunch of people that were going to prevent me from making a fool of myself. My wife would read the first draft. My editor publisher was a woman. My agent is a woman. And then I have some really good female colleagues and friends who I trust enough to hand over a raw manuscript and ask for an opinion, and with the confidence that the opinion will be honest and intelligent. So I had all that as kind of a backup position, and I had the nerve and the life experience to be able to imagine myself in the psychological and emotional space that a woman inhabits. And so I gave it a try. And now I'm at the mercy of a readership, every member of which is entitled to her own assessment of how successfully I pulled it off.
Yeah, the reviews have been generally pretty good about on that score. The book, as I mentioned in the introduction to this interview, is seen through the eyes of Effie. What's she like?
Effie is a woman in her 50s. She's had a very tough personal life in relation to men. She grew up with a dark and troubled father who behaved erratically and sometimes inappropriately with her. As a young woman, she didn't quite know what he was up to a lot of the time, and it was just that it was scary and sinister. But it did shape her in the sense of her trying to figure out what she wanted in a relationship, and that you sort of start off kind of out of kilter, and you look for things in a relationship, especially when you're young, that you probably can't realistically expect to get back from another young person. So she had a couple of failed marriages. She had some interesting but ultimately unsuccessful long-term relationships, a lot of brief relationships, a couple of attempted reconciliations with this peculiar ex-husband she had. And so she reaches middle age, and as a lot of women do when they reach middle age, she realizes, you know, I can sit back now and decide, what do I need? What do people need from me? Maybe it's time for me to start thinking about myself a little bit more than I have in the past. And maybe it's time for me to reassess what I really want out of a relationship. It's not the same as when I was 19 or 20 or even 30. So she's going through all that, and she's coming to the rather liberating conclusion that she doesn't need men the same way she once did, and she doesn't really care what they need from her. And she's kind of hitting a sort of sense of autonomy. And then, of course, in a chance encounter, she runs into the guy that I suppose a lot of women dream about, somebody who seems to be sophisticated and mature and sexy and intelligent and thoughtful, and it's irresistible, and this relationship blooms. She's a tenured university professor with a PhD in history, specializing in Celtic history and languages. She's pretty solidly secured in that regard. Plus, one of her unsuccessful past relationships was with a fairly shady, maybe criminal, but well-to-do guy who died suddenly and left her a lot of money. And so she's economically stable at middle age, and it's only in the emotional sphere that she's sort of got some questions. And then she meets this man named J.C. Campbell, who seems to take care of that. So life looks pretty perfect all of a sudden.
Yeah. Now, in your career in journalism, did you encounter a lot of J.C. Campbells?
Oh, yeah. J.C. Campbell and I covered a lot of stories together. We were in a lot of strange places together. And I was always, interested in the fact that he kept himself pretty free of personal commitments. He was always single, and the job always came first. He was smart and resourceful. I always kind of admired the J.C. Campbells that I ran into in complicated places. And so it was pretty easy for me to imagine this guy in this book and to kind of present him as I saw him and as Effie saw him, as sort of like a perfect kind of partner for a long-term commitment.
I've just turned 30, so I'm interested in reading this book. Perhaps I'll pick up something about what the next few years will be like for me.
A couple decades,
yeah. Do you think there is something that one could learn about growing older from this book, or from men of a certain age, say?
It's not a self-help book, Joe. It's not prescriptive. It's just a bunch of stories. Or it's a story with a bunch of sub-stories. But if you're reading it from the point of view you just sort of mentioned, I think that what you should become aware of, without being preached at, mm-hmm. is the fact that when you hit your 50s, an awful lot of the certainties and a lot of the things you take for granted start to get a little bit wobbly. No matter how sophisticated or modern or metrosexual we are, in terms of identity and the rest of it, we still are rooted in primitive notions of what makes a man a man. And those things usually have something to do with power and influence, strength, and just how we are perceived by other people, and in a very large way, women. And you hit 50s, and a lot of these things start to change. Your sense of your masculinity and your virility and your power begins to change. And for a period of time, you become maybe a little bit less confident about your value, your worth as a human being. And this is when a lot of men get kind of weird. A lot of long-term marriages break up at this point because the guy suddenly wants the reassurance you get from the attention of a much younger woman, shall I say. Mm. Someone who makes you feel 25 again or 30 again. You become a little bit less confident of your physical assets. Your career evolution has probably plateaued out or even turned down. And you're just not as sure of yourself as you once were. And men are not good at admitting that. Men are not good at admitting anything that gives away uncertainty or sense of, or weakness, and so we end up at that vulnerable part of our lives, faking things, being deceptive, trying to get reassurance from other people, without actually coming right out and saying I'm afraid, or I'm not quite so sure of myself anymore. And this is when we get into deception and actual sort of self-serving. That's what the book ultimately is all about.
Do you think you're a better man having written this?
No. I think that I've thought my way, to the extent that I've thought my way through an awful lot of challenges that might otherwise just have express themselves emotionally, I can now rationalize and think my way through certain impulses and certain feelings and insecurities. I can think my way past them now, rather than just heading out to the bar or brooding. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, yeah, the book has taken me to a better place. Whether it's made me a better person or not, I wouldn't even attempt to assess.
Now, when you write these books, these three novels thus far, do you have a sense of who the reader is? I mean, is it for men, or are your readers predominantly female, perhaps?
The readership is predominantly female, and women, God bless them, seem to be interested in fiction, and they're also interested in how men see things, and they're particularly interested when a man writes a book that confesses something that adds up to uncertainty. So I think once the book is written and published, it becomes the property of whoever happens to be reading it. And I just sort of write, I suppose, with a sense that somebody, a stranger, is going to sit down and read this, but I have to come to the conclusion that this stranger, I will have something in common with this person, no matter who he or she is or where, because at a particular level, you know, we all have the same concerns and the same interests, and they basically have to do with existence and death and just how we get through this process that we never really had much to do with in the first place. So I just assume that the person who's going to be reading my stuff is going to be a little bit like me, and that they're interested in large issues of life and death and getting by. But beyond that, I don't tailor the book to a man or a woman or a particular sensibility. I don't really care how many books get sold, although I want to justify the gamble taken by a publisher or a book buyer. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I just hope that the book is, you know, the book in many ways is like my kids. You do your best when you have control over them, and then you send them out with your fingers crossed, and you hope that they're well received, and that they have, that they make a contribution to other people's lives, and that they live happily ever after. But beyond that, you have no control, and it's best not to worry about it too much.
Will you write more novels?
I got one underway right now. It's about a third of the way through a first draft. And it's a different set of characters, a different set of circumstances, but it once again, it sort of goes to the same places that I've always been interested in going journalistically, into, you know, matters of public consequence, matters about, you know, how institutions work and how well they serve people and how people react when institutions fail them or institutions don't do what we expect of them. And then some of the complexities that will arise when an institution like, for example, the justice system lets us down. What do you do then when you're looking for reassurance that your community is safe and you're safe, and suddenly you see the justice system do something that contradicts that expectation? So that's the sort of the subject I'm on now, and it's a story that's taking shape with characters that are starting to become real people, which is a sign that I may someday finish it.
Yeah. Now, the Giller Prize that you won a couple years ago,
yeah.
Did that validate whatever abilities you thought you had for being a novelist?
I think it inevitably causes other people to take you seriously. It doesn't, you know, it is recognition of a particular book in a particular set of circumstances, and it is validation of the author only in the sense that it tells people that, well, this person can write a book that, or he wrote a book that succeeded, and it might indicate that he can do it again. But it's not a guarantee. The circumstances that make a good book a successful book, and there are a lot of good books that aren't successful books, and then there are conversely a lot of successful books that aren't good books, but the circumstances that make it for a successful book are way beyond the control of whoever writes the book. They have to do with just the mood of the times, circumstances that might draw special attention to the book, like a prize, or in the case of the Bishop's Men, with a whole lot of circumstances because of the scandals in the Catholic Church. And this was about a priest, Catholic priest, who was, whose job was dealing with fallout from scandals. So all this stuff came together to bring a lot of attention to that book. A lot of people picked it up for that reason, and then the secondary effect kicks in, where a whole lot of people who might not otherwise have read it read it and say, "Oh, I liked it. It was a good read," and they tell other people, and then you get the very important spin-off effect, which is the word of mouth effect, and so the book becomes phenomenally successful, which that one did. But it doesn't guarantee. It guarantees that when the book, next book comes out, your name is familiar.
Right.
And the second book will always be mentioned in context of the other book. But the second book, or third book in my case, it has to be good on its own merit. It has to, like, it has to satisfy people, because people aren't going to read Why Men Lie and say, "Well, it must be good because the other one, I like the other one." They're going to read this one, and they're going to forget about the other one, hopefully, within about 20 pages. And this book is going to have to make it on its own. And if it fails, it'll fail big, because it's got a whole lot of attention now because of the other book.
Lyndon, it's been a pleasure talking today. I've been a fan of yours on the Fifth Estate for many years, and I'm looking forward to reading this book. Continued good luck with it.
Okay, well, I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you'll feel free to let me know if you hate it. And conversely, let me know if you like it.
Will do, will do.
Okay, Joseph, thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
The book is called Why Men Lie. It's published by Random House. Its author, Lyndon McIntyre, was on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.